This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I am Grace Cavalieri. I'm in the studios of the Library of Congress with Arthur Z., newly appointed Poet Laureate of the United States. May I be 1,000th person to welcome you and to congratulate you. We are so excited about this, Arthur.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here.
And please let everyone know who you are with an opening poem.
This first poem I'm going to read is called Swimming Laps, and it's from my latest book, Into the Hush. Swimming Laps. Swimming backstroke toward the far end of a pool in sunlight. Yellow flares in the nearby aspens. In the pre-dawn sky, Mars and Venus glimmered. How is it a glimmering moment coalesces and the rest slides like flour through a sieve? How is it these glimmerings become constellations in a pre-dawn sky? Reaching the wall, I turn and push off swimming freestyle. How is it we bobbed in water beyond the breaking surf, and I taste that salt in my mouth now? How is it, disheveled, breathless, we drew each other up into flame? How is it that flame burns steadily within? Reaching the wall, I turn and push off swimming side stroke. With each scissors kick, I know time's shears. This is not pre-dawn to a battle when the air dips to a windless calm. Let each day be lived risking, feeling, loving, alive to ivy reddening along the fence. Reaching the wall, I turn and push off swimming breaststroke. How is it I see below then above a horizon line? How is it I didn't sputter, slosh, end up staring at a Geiger counter clock mounted on a barroom wall? I, who have no answers, find glimmering shards. Reaching the wall, I pause, climb out of the pool, start a new day.
The voice of Arthur Z., 25th Poet Laureate of the United States. I've been reading your work since book one. And now I want to ask you what you think has happened over the years in your work. How do you see it different?
Well, I'm 75, and to look back over 50 years of writing is pretty amazing. It's been such a gift to have that time to write and grow, and it's been quite a journey. I would say my early poems were modeled on ancient Chinese poems because I learned my craft through translating classical Chinese poetry. So I started with very short, compressed poems. And then I got to a stage where that felt too confining to me. So I sort of broke that model apart, and I wanted to put more of the world into the poem. And I started to write sequences where I could change place and time from section to section, or voice, or play with tonal shifts. And those middle books, I think, got quite complex and challenging. And then in my most recent phase, I feel like there's a kind of simplification, like the poem I just read has a kind of simplicity, a structure and language, but hopefully it has a depth of feeling and clarity too.
Well, you were always pointillistic and always a naturalist, I think, from the beginning. But what I believe is that the first poems were more consciously made. It seems that now your poems come from somewhere else, the wind maybe, but it is not that we are not conscious of someone making a poem. It's whether you trust the reader more or you don't care more, but it is coming from a different place. Because if I'm aware of what you wrote and I've watched you over the years, and I definitely see a change in your poetry. And in my world, we use the word Enzo. And so that is your work. you never complete the circle. And so perhaps I'll let you describe it, but it is that one belief in the space that is where you live. Would you tell us what Enzo means to you?
Enzo to me means drawing a circle which has no beginning and no end. So oftentimes in Zen art, the Zen teachers came to the stage where they realized you can only do so much with language, and taking a brush and ink and drawing the circle was a statement and a depiction in itself of the infinite that's there in the finite. And some Zen artists fracture the circle, so it's like two halves. Some Zen artists draw it in one continuous motion, and you literally cannot see where the beginning and the end is. And other Zen masters, I'm thinking of Hakuin in Japan, drew the Enzo, and then he wrote a little comment beside the Enzo. And those are usually like koans, things to puzzle over about the nature of existence. So when Hakuin drew the Enzo, he drew the circle, and then he wrote, "No space in the 10 directions, not one inch of great earth." And you as a viewer are supposed to ponder that.
Well, do you believe that that is the soul of your writing?
I don't know if it's the soul, but it's certainly a really important fundamental point that I draw on.
It teaches me so much. And so please let us hear another poem from Arthur Z. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri on a marvelous day in my life.
So I'm going to turn to an earlier book called Archipelago, and the opening poem, Streamers, is a sequence in six sections, and the very last section uses the word Enzo. So you just have to imagine there are things happening. It starts with an image of the northern lights shooting across the sky, which is an arc of a circle. But here in the last section with the word Enzo, I'll read the culmination. Red koi swim toward us, and black carp are rising out of the depths of the pond. But our sustenance is a laugh, a grief, a walk at night in the snow. Seeing the pure gold of a flickering candle, a moment at dusk when we see that deer have been staring at us, we did not see them edge out of the brush. A moment when someone turns on a light and turns a window into a mirror. A moment when a child asks, "When will it be tomorrow?" To say a bell cannot be red and violet at the same place and time because of the logical structure of color is true, but is a dot that must enlarge into a zero, a void, Enzo, red shimmer, breath, endless beginning, pure body, pure mind.
Have you written in every form there is? I mean, I know your pantoum, more than one. Have you written in the ghazal, ode, villanelle? Have you written in every form?
I have not. Yes, I have two pantoums that I wrote for the first time in my new book.
Yes.
I have a haibun, which is based on the Japanese prose and haiku. I have a prose poem that uses haiku, tanka, renku, linked verse, and haibun. I have a letter poem in my new book, Into the Hush, and I have unrhymed sonnets. They're 14 lines, but for me, when I write with rhyme and meter, it feels forced. It feels too artificial.
Well, that's interesting because your pantoum, you know, A, B, D, E, B, D, you can't even notice the structure. So when you write in form, it melts. It melts the form. You don't know its form. And the structure remains, but it is, the earth is softened. You do not know the form. I think that is so interesting. Isn't that what you want?
Yes, absolutely. And let me just say, when I wrote these first two pantoums, I followed the rules,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
The second and fourth lines become the first and third lines. the following stanza, but the repetition seemed a little predictable to me. So then I thought, what can I do? And my innovation was to add a caesura, a silence, yes, inside of each line and shift the silence so it changed the rhythm and the tension of each line.
But it's still A, B, C. It's still, yes, follow the formula. And it makes it a very unified, but also without walls. What an accomplishment. I'd love to hear that.
So here's the second pantoum I wrote. It's called Shadows of Flames. Juniper crackles and pinyon smoke scents the room. Bins of coriander, cumin, red chili powder, fenugreek. At a keyhole entrance, we gaze into the garden of the Taj. Bomb warnings pasted on glass doors and on walls. Bins of coriander, cumin, red chili powder, fenugreek. Shadows of flames wash across our bodies. Bomb warnings pasted on glass doors and on walls. Bar-tailed godwits fly 8,000 miles before stopping. Shadows of flames wash across our bodies. Small circles, large circles. Circumference is everywhere. Bar-tailed godwits fly 8,000 miles before stopping. Quicksilver lightning, peony moon, this kiss. Small circles, large circles, circumference is everywhere. At a keyhole entrance, we gaze into the garden of the Taj. Quicksilver lightning, peony moon, this kiss. Juniper crackles and pinyon smoke scents the room.
Mm. Arthur Zee was the first poet laureate of Santa Fe, New Mexico. He was a chancellor of the Academy of American Poets and was elected a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He's a professor emeritus at the Institute of American Indian Arts. You know, you use no one. Could there be anyone who knows more about plant life and birds, the names of things, than you do? Have you been chronicling them since childhood? Have you been writing down the names of plants and birds your whole life?
I have not, but I can remember in junior high school that the teacher assigned to all the students in the class to go and collect some leaves in the neighborhood. And I got so fascinated by collecting leaves. She expected, you know, each student to collect maybe 5 or 10 or 15 at most. And I started collecting leaves, and I was so fascinated by the different shapes and the combinations that I thought, I'll just keep going. And I remember she was totally startled when I showed up, and I said, I think I've got 125 different trees here that I found in the neighborhood, and here are their leaves. So that started early.
But did you name the leaves?
I did look them up in field guides,
well,
and then I was able to find them.
That started early, because I think of you wandering around Santa Fe, looking at things and noticing things. And then I think, you know, you look, well, it's a spiritual practice that you teach us to notice things. But then I think, does he write down everything he sees? Does he have time to write them down? Because you see and watch everything, not look. You really see. And that is what your poetry teaches us. If ever, as teachers, we can get the students to stop and notice things, we can just leave for the day. And that is your spiritual practice.
That's such a beautiful way of articulating it. I feel like poetry has such a vital role to play in our lives. We're in such a hurry. We move at really quick speeds. And the sacrifices, we tend to stay on the surface because of that. In poetry, is resistant to that. You cannot speed read Emily Dickinson or Walt Whitman. You would cheat yourself of the pleasure and experience of poetry. And poetry asks us to delve deep. And as you say, to notice deeply, to experience the sounds and rhythms of language. So I feel very much a part of that lineage.
It is so true. And you teach us that more than anyone else. You have to notice bad things sometimes, too. Like, you have benzene, you have atoms, you have detonation. So how does science intrude on your reverie?
That's a wonderful question. You know, I started writing late. I was actually a freshman at MIT in a calculus lecture, and I was totally bored by the math, and I turned to the back of my notebook and started writing. Like many Asian Americans, I grew up with the pressure to be good at math and science. I was good at math and science. I had no idea what I wanted to do in high school, so I applied to MIT. I got in, and that very first semester, I just looked at the equations on a whiteboard and thought, I can do this, but do I really want to spend my life doing this? No. And I started writing and writing and writing. And so it took me a while to get comfortable using the structure of science, but I maybe would like to share this short poem from Into the Hush. It's called Vectors.
I know it, and I love it.
And this uses, of course, science in its structure, vectors. First, extinction in the Galapagos Islands, the least vermilion flycatcher. Hopis drill a foot deep and plant blue corn along a wash. Danger, a woman brushed on the side of a napalm bomb. In an oblong box emptied of firewood, a black widow web. Shaving, he nicked himself and stared in the mirror in a moment of blood. Out of a saddlebag, a teen pulls a severed goat's head. Before signing his name, he recalls hotel rooms were once used as torture chambers. In Thessaloniki, the beach attendant made a gun of his hand and fired at him. Prisoners cackled when the inmate on stage said, "Is it not time for my painkiller?" Weighing mushrooms, the Tibetan cashier grins. "You suffer from suspicion. I suffer from kindness." A mercenary-turned-car mechanic spilled a pile of Krugerrands onto the table. Looking up from a tusk under the lamp, the carver smiled. "It's butter in my hands."
Arthur Z is a poet, translator, and an editor, author of 12 books of poetry. I just have to read the awards. Bollingen, the Bollingen Prize, the National Book Award. Finalist for the Pulitzer, the Southwest Book Award, the Balcones Poetry Prize, the American Literary Award, the American Book Award, to be continued. This is what I think being a Zen poet is, owning the world and not caring. And I think you like the honors, you value them, but I think deeply they're not yourself. And I think that is perhaps you've brought Zen. Would you say that of contemporary poetry, you brought Zen into the world more than any other? I think so.
I don't know that I can say that. Certainly Zen is important to me, and that sense of non-attachment is important to me. I think of Wallace Stevens, who once wrote, and he said, poetry is a source of pleasure, not of honors. And so... Yes, I'm grateful for the awards that have come. I haven't looked for them necessarily, and certainly they've given me time to write or encouragement. But ultimately, it's the pleasure of writing, the discovery. I just love how poetry is our essential language, its intensity, its musicality, and that's what keeps me learning. I feel like I'm still a beginner in the best sense.
Yes, the beginner's mind is the one that the mind that knows everything. The expert knows just a little bit, right? Well, please let us hear another, Arthur Z.
Here's a poem called Wildfire Season. The wind stokes flames, and they leap across the fire line to the north. A jagged red and yellow ridge line crackles with billowing clouds of smoke. To the far north, a singer stretches walrus bladder, and completing a box drum, starts to hum. He nods as a song takes shape in his hands. The smallest subatomic particles trace the birth of the cosmos. Traces of scorpion venom will lead to new cures. One day they will extract heavy metals from the moon. The spider in a sink sips from a droplet of water. Leafcutter ants will one day march across a radioactive forest. In this wind, pear trees unfold white blossoms, shape a song as time detonates inside of time.
More awards: the Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize, the Shelley Memorial Award, the Poetry Society of America, Jackson Poetry Prize, the Lannan Literary Award, the Guggenheim, the Wallace Readers. I just had to say that. But you know, when I think of the Zen part of your poetry, it sometimes takes a strange appearance. I'm thinking of the word, the poem Floaters. It ends with, and his hands disappear, and his hands disappear, and his hands disappear three times. And at the end, when words shimmer, you think, the words are going to shimmer, but they don't. The hands shimmer.
Yes.
That is the secret of Zen. Right there. The secret. It is nothing and everything, and the most surprising thing. I had finished that poem for you. I thought, the words are going to shimmer. Good ending. No, the hands. That is it. What a thing. What a thing.
Maybe I should read Floaters with that.
That would be
fun?
Cool.
Okay, great. So this is section 5 in a suite of 9 poems, Floaters. Driving past a phalanx of white tombstones along a south-facing slope, I recall, no one hates war like soldiers. From a mechanic replacing an oil pump in a Fiat engine. Then another floater appears when I blink. Peach blossoms on flowing water go into the distance. And as I ponder how a line written in 740 stays present tense, a curve-billed thrasher nests in a cleft of spined choya. A man on ayahuasca types with his hands, and his hands disappear. He types with his hands, and his hands disappear. Shimmer the words as his hands disappear.
Blows me away. Blows me away. I also want to talk about the motion in your work. What do you think about motion?
I think of motion in tension with stillness. So again, there's a very Zen aspect to that. The idea, kind of like yin and yang, where you have, instead of a circle cut in half with black and white, there's a white swirl and a black swirl, and the black swirl contains a dot of white, and the white swirl contains a black dot. They need each other. So stillness and motion need each other. So one of the things I'm conscious of is moving things along like a stream of images.
Always. The wind is always blowing. The stream is rippling. Is motion really all we have?
Hard to say. Hard to know. It's
That's
always slipping
Zen
through
answer.
Our hands.
That's a good Zen answer. Hard to know. I'll remember that one.
Okay.
And the other great portion that I've been thinking a lot about is your silence. Is your silence. You know, Jury Graham talks about the space on the page as listening. But I think she believes it's the reader's listening place. I think it's the poem listening. In your work, I think your poetry listens to itself on the page. And I think I'm right.
I agree, and thank you. What a wonderful insight and way of looking at silence. And I think oftentimes the poem leads us to discover things we didn't know that were right here in front of us.
I hope so.
Yes.
What are we doing? And they say silence is where the divine lives. I believe that.
In the very first poem I read, Swimming Laps, the poem's constructed in one-line stanzas, and I wanted those silences, those spaces, to work against the sound so that they need each other, and there's that stillness and then the motion of language. So for me, there's that sort of endless interplay and sense of tension and discovery.
Swimming is a good metaphor for that, but also it's about breathing. It's not about the water. It's about breathing.
Absolutely.
May we have a final poem?
I'm going to turn to my collected poems here, new and collected, The Glass Constellation, and this poem is called First Snow. A rabbit has stopped on the gravel driveway, imbibing the silence, you stare at spruce needles. There's no sound of a leaf blower, no sign of a black bear. A few weeks ago, a buck scraped his rack against an aspen trunk. A carpenter scribed a plank along a curved stone wall. You only spot the rabbit's ears and tail. When it moves, you locate it against speckled gravel. But when it stops, it blends in again. The world of being is like this gravel. You think you own a car, a house, this blue zigzagged shirt, but you just borrow these things. Yesterday, you constructed an aqueduct of dreams and stood at Gibraltar. But you possess nothing. Snow melts into a pool of clear water. And in this stillness, starlight behind daylight, wherever you gaze.
The voice of Arthur Zee, our poet laureate of the United States. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family, and friends of the program, Natalie Canivore, Avi Day Shashani, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Our engineer is Sandy Kinlock. I am Grace Cavalieri.